This is Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today's subject will be arguments against skepticism. This topic came about because I was searching through the internet and I came upon a very interesting website. Apparently the author is D. Owens. And I don't know his or her full name because when I sent the email with responses to their questions, the email address was no longer valid, so I wasn't able to contact them. So I'll just have to refer to him as D. Owens. And it was part of a news group called ALT.Paranormal. So you may have an idea where this person's coming from. The subject of his site was Stupid Skeptic Tricks. In fact, he makes a top 10 list. So let me begin. Before getting into his website, I think it's important that we go over the definitions of the people who populate the two sides of most debates. Skeptics are those people who only accept as true that which has been proven to be true by the application of some form of the scientific method. True believers, on the other hand, accept claims on blind faith without requiring proof. And I'm referring to real, actual proof, not the things that true believers try to claim is proof. However, there is one time that they do require proof, and that is when they are arguing against science. Why do they require proof of science, but have no problem believing other claims that have no proof? That's because their unsupported beliefs always fail scientific standards of proof, and therefore they must reject science in order to hold on to their beliefs. Let's get right into his website and his list. He will list the top 10 stupid skeptic tricks, as he calls them. So I get the impression that this is a kind of David Letterman ripoff. Okay, let's begin. This is how he starts. He says, "Ever get into an argument with a skeptic only to end up exasperated and feeling you've been bamboozled? Skeptics are often highly skilled at tying up opponents in clever verbal knots. Most skeptics are, of course, ordinary, more or less honest people who, like the rest of us, are just trying to make the best sense they can of a complicated and often confusing world. Others, however, are merely glib sophists who use specious reasoning to defend their prejudices or attack the ideas and beliefs of others. And even an honest skeptic can innocently fall into the mistake of employing bad reasoning." Okay, let me respond to that opening paragraph. What he's done is he has completely turned the truth around 180 degrees and tried to claim that skeptics are guilty of the things that actually describe the way that true believers argue. Let me reread the last sentence, substituting the words "true believers" for "skeptics." "However," he says, "true believers are merely glib sophists who use specious reasoning to defend their prejudices or attack the ideas and beliefs of others." Now that would be an accurate statement, but he had it completely turned around. He goes on to say, "In reading, listening to, and sometimes debating skeptics over the years, I've found certain tricks, ploys, and gimmicks which they tend to use over and over again. Here are some of them. Perhaps if you keep them in mind when arguing with a skeptic, you'll feel better when the debate is over. Shucks, you might even score a point or two." Now, I don't know if he put these in top 10 order like David Letterman does. I'll just read them in the order that he put them. The first one is raising the bar, or as he calls it, impossible perfection. This trick consists of demanding a new, higher, and more difficult standard of evidence whenever it looks as if a skeptic's opponent is going to satisfy an old one. Often the skeptic doesn't make it clear exactly what the standards are in the first place. This can be especially effective if the skeptic can keep his opponent from noticing that he is continually changing his standard of evidence. That way, his opponent will eventually give up in exasperation or disgust. Perhaps best of all, If his opponent complains, the skeptic can tag him as a whiner or a sore loser. He now gives an example. The skeptic says, I am willing to consider the psi hypotheses, that's PSI, as an extrasensory perception, if you will only show me some sound evidence. The opponent replies, there are many thousands of documented reports of incidents that seem to involve psi. Skeptic, that is only anecdotal evidence. You must give me laboratory evidence. Opponent, researchers A through Z have conducted experiments that produced results which favor the psi hypothesis. Skeptic, those experiments are not acceptable because of flaws X, Y, and Z. Opponent, researchers B through H and T through W have conducted experiments producing positive results which did not have flaws X, Y, and Z. Skeptic, the positive results are not far enough above chance levels to be truly interesting. Opponent, researchers C through F and U through V produced results well above chance levels. Skeptic, their results were achieved through meta-analysis, which is a highly questionable technique. Opponent, meta-analysis is a well-accepted method commonly used in psychology and sociology. Skeptic, psychology and sociology are social sciences, and their methods can't be considered as reliable as those of hard sciences such as physics and chemistry. Now I feel I need to reply to number one. Refuting arguments is not the same thing as raising the bar. Raising the bar occurs when an answer is given and the other person can't deal with the answer, so they ask another question that is even more difficult. No matter how many times you answer their question, they will never deal with your answer because they can't. So they resort to asking questions that get more impossible to answer. Their goal is to finally get you into a position where you can't answer their impossible question, and then they will stop raising the bar and claim victory. Don't let them raise the bar on you. Once you realize what they are up to, you have to stop them by refusing to play along. Skeptics train to avoid committing logical fallacies. True believers are the ones who use this tactic, not skeptics. Number two, Occam with Occam. Skeptics frequently invoke Occam's razor as if the razor automatically validates their position. Occam's razor, a principle of epistemology, which is knowledge theory, states that the simplest explanation which fits all the facts is to be preferred. Or to state it another way, entities are not to be multiplied needlessly. The razor is a useful and even necessary principle, but it is largely useless if the facts themselves are not generally agreed upon in the first place. Basically, I agree with him. At the end, he says the razor is a useful and even necessary principle. So we're in agreement with that. And where he says it's largely useless if the facts are not generally agreed upon, I have to agree with that too. In a court of law, facts are what both sides stipulate as to being incontestable. You can argue about the meaning of the facts, but the facts themselves cannot be challenged in a court of law. So, obviously, the facts have to be agreed upon as a starting point. Number three, extraordinary claims. Extraordinary claims, says the skeptic, require extraordinary evidence. Superficially, this seems reasonable enough. However, extraordinariness, like beauty, is very much in the eye of the beholder. Some claims, of course, would seem extraordinary to almost anyone. For example, the claim that aliens from Alpha Centauri had contacted you telepathically and inform you that the people of Earth must make you their absolute lord and ruler. The extraordinariness of many other claims, however, is at best arguable, and it is not at all obvious that unusually strong evidence is necessary to support them. For example, so many people who would ordinarily be considered reliable witnesses have reported precognitive dreams that it becomes difficult to insist these are unusual claims requiring unusual evidence. Quite ordinary standards of evidence will do. In regard to number three, I agree with him. I am the skeptic. I'm supposed to be fighting every point, but I completely agree with him, especially his last sentence, which I thought was eloquent. Quite ordinary standards of evidence will do. I think that there's no reason to require extraordinary evidence for any claim. Evidence is evidence. Either it's evidence that it exists or that it doesn't. I never have really understood why they would require extraordinary evidence. I don't even know what extraordinary evidence is. So, as much as I hate to admit it, I'm on his side on that one. Number four, stupid, crazy liars. This trick consists of a simple slander. Anyone who reports anything which displeases the skeptic will be accused of incompetence, mental illness, or dishonesty, or some combination of the three, without a single shred of fact to support the accusations. When Charles Honorton's Gansfield experiments produced impressive results in favor of the psi hypotheses, skeptics accused him of suppressing or not publishing the results of failed experiments. No definite facts supporting the charge ever emerged. Moreover, the experiments were extremely time-consuming, and the number of failed unpublished experiments necessary to make the number of successful published experiments significant would have been quite high. So it is extremely unlikely that Honorton's results could be due to selective reporting. Yet skeptics still sometimes repeat this accusation. Okay, my response to that. The logical fallacy of personal attack is employed by everyone. However, since skeptics should be trained in their use, I believe that that tactic would much more likely be employed by a true believer. Regarding the Gansfield experiments, I would refer you to my website, theskepticarena.com, where you will find a vast resource of links, and I would suggest you try the Skeptics Dictionary, where you will find an in-depth discussion of the experiments. Number five, he calls the Santa Claus Gambit. This trick consists of lumping moderate claims or propositions together with extreme ones. If you suggest, for example, that Sasquatch can't be completely ruled out from the available evidence, the skeptic will then facetiously suggest that Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny can't be completely ruled out either. Well, to that I say, who determines what constitutes a moderate versus an extreme claim? He has taken the position that Sasquatch is a moderate claim. Skeptics would disagree. Now we get to one of the most important ones. This is probably the central point of this entire show. Number six, shifting the burden of evidence. The skeptic insists that he doesn't have to provide evidence and arguments to support his side of the argument because he isn't asserting a claim. He is merely denying or doubting yours. Pay attention to this next sentence. His mistake consists of assuming that a negative claim, which is asserting that something doesn't exist, is fundamentally different from a positive claim. It isn't. Any definite claim, positive or negative, requires definite support. Merely refuting or arguing against an opponent's position is not enough to establish one's own position. In other words, you can't win by default. Okay, now it's my turn. I believe that D. Owen's invention of the concept of negative claim is completely illogical. For example, if I claim I can float up to the ceiling, the burden of proof is on me to prove that I can do it. You have no obligation to try to prove that I can't. And by not believing me, that does not mean that you are making a claim that I can't do it. I would be the one making the claim. This is the most common, and unfortunately probably the most successful, trick used by true believers to convince people of things when they cannot prove their claims. Skeptics believe in what has been proven by science. If he wants to debate gravity, then let's go outside and go to a rooftop and we'll test his theory against Newton's. And he continues, as arch skeptic Carl Sagan himself said, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. If someone wants to rule out visitation by extraterrestrial aliens, it would not be enough to point out that all the evidence presented so far is either seriously flawed or not very strong. It would be necessary to state definite reasons which would make ET visitations either impossible or highly unlikely. He might, for example, point out that our best understanding of physics pretty much rules out any kind of effective faster-than-light drive. The only person exempt from providing definite support is the person who takes a strict I-don't-know position, or the agnostic position. If someone takes the position that the evidence in favor of ET visitations is inadequate, but goes no farther, he is exempt from further argument, provided, of course, he gives adequate reasons for rejecting the evidence. However, if he wants to go farther and insists that it is impossible or highly unlikely that ETs are visiting or have visited Earth, it becomes necessary for him to provide definite reasons for his position. He is no longer entitled merely to argue against his opponent's position. So I'll break in here again with my own little comment. Once again, the illogical concept of negative claim has shifted the burden away from the person who cannot defend or prove his claim, which just happens to be the intent of the true believer. Getting back to the end of this long number six, there is the question of honesty. Someone who claims to take the agnostic position, but really takes the position of definite disbelief, is, of course, misrepresenting his views. For example, a skeptic who insists that he merely believes the psi hypothesis is inadequately supported, when in fact he believes that the human mind can only acquire information through physical senses, is simply not being honest. I can't argue with that. I would agree. That would be dishonest if someone did that. Number seven, you can't prove a negative. The skeptic may insist that he is relieved of the burden of evidence and argument because you can't prove a negative. But you most certainly can prove a negative. When we know one thing to be true, then we also know that whatever flatly contradicts it is untrue. If I want to show my cat's not in the bedroom, I can prove this by showing that my cat's in the kitchen or outside chasing squirrels. The negative has then been proven. Or the proposition that the cat is not in the bedroom could be proven by giving the bedroom a good search without finding the cat. The skeptic who says, of course I can't prove psi doesn't exist. I don't have to. You can't prove a negative. Is simply wrong. To rule something out, definite reasons must be given for ruling it out. Okay, I'll respond to that. I agree with D. Owens that you can prove a negative. But again, the burden of proof is not on the skeptic to prove that negative. The burden of proof is on the claimant to prove he can do what he says he can do, or to prove that what he believes is in fact true. Just because I can't prove that he can't float up to the ceiling does not mean that I have to accept his claim. I will accept his claim when he proves he can do it. But the true believers never can prove their claims, which is why they resort to the distraction technique of trying to trick you into thinking that you must disprove their claim. You don't have to disprove anything. And he goes on to say, of course, for practical reasons, it often isn't possible to gather the necessary information to prove or disprove a proposition. It isn't possible to search the entire universe to prove that no intelligent extraterrestrial life exists. This by itself doesn't mean that a case can't be made against the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence, although it does probably mean that the case can't be as airtight and conclusive as we would like. And my reply to that is, once again, I agree with his conclusion. I agree with that last paragraph. Number eight, the big lie. The skeptic knows that most people will not have the time or inclination to check every claim he makes, so he knows it's a fairly small risk to tell a whopper. He might, for example, insist that none of the laboratory evidence for psi stands up to close scrutiny. Or he might insist there have been no cases of UFOs being spotted by reliable observers such as trained military personnel, when in fact there are well-documented cases. The average person isn't going to scamper right down to the library to verify this. So the skeptic knows a lot of people are going to accept his statement at face value. This ploy works best when the big lie is repeated often and loudly in a confident tone. I have something to say about that. Regarding his first sentence, where he was talking about the skeptic lying about UFOs and psi evidence, and the person not being able to verify it, the skeptic does not make the claim. This stems from his misuse of the concept of negative claim, as I stated previously. He started right out by saying the skeptic's claim. He's got it backwards. Almost always, it's a true believer that's making a claim that the skeptic does not accept, because the skeptic only accepts what's been proven by science. And his conclusion about people not going down to check it out and this big lie is repeated often and loudly in a confident tone, I would totally agree with his conclusion if it were describing a true believer. The reason why a true believer must resort to this tactic is precisely because they do not have the facts and or evidence on their side. They are the ones who do what he is accusing the skeptics of doing. Once again, he's turned the truth around 180 degrees and just presented it as a fact. Number 9, doubt casting. This trick consists of dwelling on minor or trivial flaws in the evidence, or presenting speculations as to how the evidence might be flawed, as though mere speculation is somehow as damaging as actual facts. The assumption here is that any flaw, trivial or even merely speculative, is necessarily fatal and provides sufficient grounds for throwing out the evidence. The skeptic often justifies this with the extraordinary evidence ploy. In the real world, of course, the evidence for anything is seldom 100% flawless and foolproof. It is almost always possible to find some small shortcoming which can be used as an excuse for tossing out evidence. If a definite problem can't be found, then the skeptic may simply speculate as to how the evidence might be flawed and use his speculations as an excuse to discard the information. For example, the skeptic might point out that the safeguards or controls during one part of the psi experiment weren't quite as tight as they might have been, and then insist, without any supporting facts, that the subjects and or researchers probably cheated, because this is the simplest explanation for the results. And I would reply to that, the ulterior motive behind the use of nearly all of the illogical fallacies is distraction. What he described was, again, mainly a ploy used by true believers who are rarely trained in the use of logical fallacies, not skeptics who are trained in that area. Once again, he just turned it around 180 degrees and accused skeptics of being guilty of exactly what true believers do. Number 10, the sneer. This gimmick is an inversion of stupid, crazy liars. In Stupid Crazy Liars, the skeptic attacked the character of those advocating certain ideas or presenting information in the hope of discrediting the information. In The Sneer, the skeptic attempts to attach a stigma to some idea or claim and implies that anyone advocating that position must have something terribly wrong with him. Anyone who believes we've been visited by extraterrestrial aliens must be a lunatic, a fool, or a con man. If you believe this, you must be a maniac, a simpleton, or a fraud. The object here is to scare others away from a certain position without having to discuss facts. Well, this is basically the same thing as number 4 above. The logical fallacy of personal attack is employed by everyone. However, that's the main tactic of the true believer, not the skeptic. And now he concludes. To be fair, some of these tricks or tactics, such as the big lie, doubt casting, and the sneer, are often used by believers as well as skeptics. Scientific creationists and Holocaust revisionists, for example, are particularly prone to use doubt casting. Other ploys, however, such as Sock'em with Occam and extraordinary claims, are generally used by skeptics and seldom by others. Well, it doesn't surprise me that he would say this, because I got the impression that he's basically a fair person. Even though he turns everything around backwards, I get the impression that his intentions are good. We just are seeing things. He sees the glass half empty. I see it half full. So I don't know that there's ever going to be any agreement. He concludes with, unfortunately, effective debating tactics often involve bad logic. For example, attacking an opponent's character, appeals to emotion, mockery and facetiousness, loaded definitions, etc. And certainly skeptics are not the only ones who are ever guilty of using manipulative and deceptive debating tactics. Even so, skeptics are just as likely as anyone else to twist their language, logic, and facts to win an argument. And keeping these tricks in mind when dealing with skeptics may very well keep you from being bamboozled. And my reply is that I think that skeptics are far less likely to commit the offenses he listed than are their true believer counterparts, and by a wide margin, mostly because of their training and critical thinking. He had one final comment. When the pin is pulled, Mr. Grenade is no longer our friend. Well, maybe we did finally find common ground. I guess I agree with that. I don't know what that means, but I guess as long as he understands it, I guess that's all that really matters. So, I think it was good that we presented the other side. I would suggest to anyone who wants to come into the arena that you study the logical fallacies as a starting point.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.